I'm Douglas Jacoby, and you're going to listen to a podcast on the Inquisition, something that most of us have probably heard of, though we may be sketchy on the details. Well, according to Oxford, that is the most authoritative English dictionary on the planet, the Inquisition is an ecclesiastical tribunal established by Pope Gregory IX about 1232 AD for the suppression of heresy. It was active chiefly in northern Italy and southern France, becoming notorious for the use of torture. In 1542, the Papal Inquisition was reestablished to combat Protestantism, eventually becoming an organ of papal government. Well, that's a definition. Can we just break that down a little bit? Inquisition comes from a Latin word inquirere, which means to inquire, just to ask. And so the inquisitor is the one who's asking the questions. It's an ecclesiastical tribunal because it's like a court. It's ecclesiastical because it pertains to the ecclesia, that is the church. And it's for suppressing heresy. I don't think this is well understood. We normally associate the word heresy with the phrase false doctrine. We say, well, if someone is coming up with some new strange teaching, those things we're warned against in Hebrews 13:9, well, then he's a heretic. Or if he denies Jesus rose from the dead, well, he might be a heretic, but the original sense is not so much about the error of the content of his belief or opinion. It's about division. Hieresis in the New Testament Greek is the word for division, for separation. So the problem is he's causing a division, and this constitutes a threat to the community, at least as much as a threat to doctrinal purity. And as the definition also says, it was an important part of combating Protestant teaching. The Reformation began in the early 1500s, and by the mid-1500s, the Roman Catholic Church is rallying. And it was for the suppression also of Muslims and Jews, particularly in the 1400s. Okay, we began with the definition. Hope it's not too dry. I'll try to keep going. Let's talk about the origins. When did this thing actually begin? And we certainly don't see Peter and Paul using the rack to force people to believe certain things. Now, it's possible. It's possible that early on, some leaders took severe measures to ensure doctrinal conformity. It could have happened in the first century, but if it did, it wasn't normative. We've never heard about it. In fact, there's no evidence at all of an inquisitor or an inquisition in church history until we get to the Middle Ages, maybe on the early side. There is a story in 385 AD, Priscilla, who was a Christian leader, and six of her followers were beheaded. They were beheaded in France, presumably for heresy. If that's true, that would post-date what is sometimes called the Great Apostasy. Remember that persecution ended, Christianity was acceptable, and the government aligned itself with church. And this is in the first few decades of the 300s. By the year 381, Christianity was the official religion of the empire, and the church, enjoying that relationship with the state, grew more and more powerful. So yes, I could imagine people being executed for heresy by church leaders in the late 4th century. But this event, again, is after the apostasy. The church had been sliding into worldliness and biblical error for many generations. The church-state was a monstrous hybrid. That is, through the influence of Constantine and those who followed him, the church and state, they were not one institution, one organism, but they were certainly moving in lockstep and very closely connected, unhealthily so. And I would say, and many would agree, that the hybrid of church-state was a creature that ought never to have existed. In fact, all the way up to 1100 AD, that is, all the way up to the start of the 12th century, local clergy maintained doctrinal discipline. You didn't have to get other people involved, generally speaking. At times, erring members were imprisoned. I don't believe they were tortured, and execution was rare. So in the early Middle Ages, there's some evidence for an Inquisition by the High Middle Ages, you know, after the year 1000, certainly before 1100. There's a prison being used. And this should not surprise us because the church increasingly patterned itself on and resembled secular society and secular leadership structures. Where was this Inquisition based? Well, it's arguable that the first Inquisition took place at Languedoc, which is in France, in the year 1184. But it was not an officially papal-sanctioned and properly named permanent institution until a few decades later, in the 1230s under Pope Gregory IX. What happened if you landed on the wrong side of things, if you ran afoul of the Inquisition? You would spend your life in prison, provided you recanted. That is, you acknowledged, repented, backed down from your errors, admitted you were wrong. If you did not, then at this point, execution was recommended. And the church leader would not be doing the execution himself. He would talk to the secular representative of government, maybe a magistrate standing right next to him, and say, well, we turn him over to you. And everyone knew what was going to happen. So I don't think people can say, well, I didn't really pull the trigger or push the button. Yeah, but you set the process in motion that you knew would lead to those deaths. And so I hold the inquisitors guilty. The Inquisition was strong, not just in France, but also in Italy, particularly northern Italy. Those who were chosen were typically monks from one of two orders, Dominicans and Franciscans. Now you might wonder, well, why monks? Well, because I think of their educational level. They knew a lot. They knew the questions to ask. And obviously, they must have enjoyed a certain degree of respect to be thus selected. But the Inquisition was not just in France and Italy. It was also, and maybe for some of us listening today, most famously in Spain. You've heard of the Spanish Inquisition. And there's a famous Monty Python sketch about the Spanish Inquisition some of you will know of. Well, the Spanish Inquisition, I'm going to give you Oxford again, was an ecclesiastical court established in Roman Catholic Spain in 1478, directed originally against converts from Judaism and Islam, but later also against Protestants. It operated with great severity until suppressed in the early 19th century. Well, that's moving close to our age, isn't it? You'll remember from grade school history, a queen and king, Isabella and Ferdinand, who were approached by Columbus. Christopher Columbus was looking for funding. That was a hard slog, a big battle. But they began to meet in 1492. So that's an important year. It was the year the Jews were expelled from Spain and really the Muslims. What was called, did you know that the Muslims captured Spain in the 700s? But there was an effort to reclaim the land. It's kind of like very, very much like a crusade. It was called the Reconquista, the Reconquest. So they're trying to push the Moors back, you know, across the Straits of Gibraltar, over the Mediterranean, into Morocco, get rid of them, suppress the Jews. This is the stuff that's going on in the late 15th century when Columbus meets Isabel and Ferdinand. Many Jews and Muslims pretended to be Christian. Now, that's not too surprising. They would change their name. They would be seen, at least at the important church events, in order not to be captured and tortured. The last execution of the Spanish Inquisition took place, it is said, in 1826. So that's not even two centuries ago. Who was killed? It was a school teacher who was a deist. Deism was the view, actually, of a lot of the founding fathers of the United States, the fledgling American Republic. Deists believed in God. They believed that God was the creator, but they did not accept that he answered prayer, did miracles. They rejected the incarnation and viewed Jesus as just a good man. So you have a school teacher, and I think it's particularly because he was a school teacher, open to the charge of corrupting the youth, who was a deist, and he was executed. The Inquisition was also established in Portugal. Of course, Portugal is almost in Spain, right? They share the peninsula. That was in 1536. Now, from Portugal, it reached colonies like Goa in southwest India. That's still there today. That was 1560. And then the Spaniards took the Inquisition to the New World. Especially notorious for the Inquisitions in Peru and Mexico. What about Galileo? Often we hear the scientist, the astronomer, Galileo Galilei, got in trouble with the Inquisition, and that is true. He got in big trouble in 1633. What is not true is that he was executed for promoting his idea that the Earth orbited the sun. You remember, inventing the telescope, he was able to see that Jupiter had moons going around it. He was able to see that, you know, Venus has various phases. New data that fitted very poorly with the old idea, the accepted idea, that everything revolved about, orbited about the Earth. So he wasn't executed, but he was censored. He was placed under house arrest. Now, many intellectuals, and really all intellectuals, were Catholics, if we're talking about Italy and other European countries. So this is hardly a case of church versus science. So most intellectuals probably agreed with Galileo, or would very soon. But they preferred that the public not be informed of the latest scientific discoveries because of the fear of destabilization. Because for people who have been taught, this is the only way to interpret scripture. If you have a different view, a heretical view in the true sense of that word, well, that can cause people to have authority problems, and that destabilizes the institution. I think that's really what was going on. One other group of persecuted persons that is of interest, I think, are the witches. A number of witches were killed. They were ferreted out by the Inquisition. And who knows what really happened. But Pope John II allowed historians to go through the Vatican archives and figure out exactly what happened and how many witches were killed during the Inquisition. Now, I don't know what the true total is, but I know the official count, and you can read it at a number of websites. It's 99. 59 in Spain, 36 Italian witches, 4 Portuguese. Now, we know Protestants also killed a small number of witches. They didn't have an Inquisition as such, though I bet that distinction would be lost on those who were being killed. In the American colonies, probably fewer than 40 witches were executed. This brings us to the next topic, which is torture and execution. Now, technically, in the Inquisition, mutilation was forbidden. You know, pulling out someone's fingernails or teeth or breaking a bone or putting them on the rack. But there was a loophole, and one of the 13th century popes created a loophole for the inquisitor, so there was a way around that. Common methods of torture, forcing people to swallow scalding liquids, you know, right down the throat. The use of the rack, which would dislocate limbs. Thumb screws, metal pincers, once they've been made red hot. Strappado. And burning. I have a link in the notes with the podcast on strappado if you're not familiar with that. Now, I had heard somewhere that hundreds of thousands of people have been executed by the Inquisition. And unfortunately, I apologize, I repeated that figure to a number of people. And I believe that was the number in Spain over the 3 centuries from the 14 to the 1700s. I think that's probably wrong. The true total seems to be in the thousands, not hundreds of thousands. I don't know where the exaggeration came from. I really should have checked it out. My bad. Not to say torture and death are somehow therefore more okay. Not at all. What about the 21st century? Did you know that the Inquisition still exists today, though without torture and death? Its current name since 1542 is this: the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Well, man, that sounds like nothing more than a glorified Bible study, but it was the Inquisition, though today torture and death are out. So let's talk about some lessons for today before the conclusion. One, maybe you've been thinking about this as I've been rabbiting on, uniformity is not the same thing as unity. It must not be mistaken for unity. You can, I guess, force someone to say certain words, but you can't convert his heart. Uniformity, unity are different. Second, church and state were separate in the early Christian period, and that separation was for the good of all. Jesus specifically forbade us to lead by authority and power, the way worldly leaders do. We were not to lord it over others. The church began to, well, there were problems with egotism. When I study church history, I can see it happening in the late second century, throughout the 300s, by the 400s, late 400s. It's getting bad. So church and state are meant to be separate, and that's important because the power will corrupt leaders. Third, where there is a high degree of social solidarity, as in tribal societies, or where they're chiefdoms, maybe in a village scenario, leaders are going to have to wrestle with these issues. That is, there may be no church state, but when society is so glued together that the whole village will follow the chief and whatever he approves or whatever he does, it would almost be as though we were being transported back to the Middle Ages. The stakes are very high, and this calls for a great sensitivity. We don't need to repeat history. What we've got to do is foster a spirit of tolerance and respect. And again, Christian leaders need to wrestle with these issues. How does this play out? What is a godly use of influence? We need to represent others fairly, number four, individuals as well as groups. It's so easy to demonize those not there to represent themselves or those who are totally outnumbered, demonizing Jews, Muslims, and heterodox Christians. That's Christians with other views. That still takes place, both without the church and within the church. And fifth, let's do take the teaching ministry seriously, but leave final judgment to God. In my role as a international Christian teacher, I encourage an atmosphere of openness, of love, respect, of dialogue. And I think too many of us take ourselves just way too seriously. We fail to distinguish the heart of the gospel, what is truly non-negotiable, from everything else. So, yes, there are dangers when teaching and doctrinal conformity are exalted beyond due measure. And it would be a tragedy, a travesty, if there were another Inquisition. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't ask questions, we shouldn't inquire, we shouldn't even take a stand. So finally, well, it's easy to condemn the Catholic Church for its extreme measures. But while the shock we may feel is merited, we in the modern age, we're likely to underestimate the seriousness with which dissent was viewed, the fear that it engendered among secular and ecclesiastical leaders, and not just in the Middle Ages, but all the way up until relatively modern times. We may miss that. Since dissent constituted sedition, heresy was taken with tremendous seriousness. If you disagreed, that dissent was sedition, and in a political sense, we're talking about treason. So heresy was an offense against the church and the state. This was not an age of freedom of speech or equity before the law. The centuries in which the Inquisition flourished were an age of social solidarity. Inquisitorial measures were adopted not so much for the good of the heretic as for the good of society by instilling fear in order to maintain conformity. Let me say that again. The point was not to, by all means, save the soul of the heretic and then rehabilitate him and put him back on the street. That doesn't seem to be the way it worked at all. The goal was to contain the false teaching, the heresy, to protect the power structures that be, and to protect society, and even through fear. Such practices, though, all these practices are absolutely forbidden to followers of Christ. Hope you learned something during the podcast. Thanks for listening.